KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Clouds tomorrow with a chance of showers, the high in the low 50s.
How could we go from an army that in World War II would dismiss a successful general to an army in Iraq in which mediocrity is acceptable, nobody wants to stick their head out, and nobody gets fired for anything except for embarrassing the institution with what they call zipper problems?
Fun to start greens indoors because then you can plant the greens in patterns and that can make your vegetable garden look really attractive.
Because we had this shared love of running, because I was passionate about counterinsurgency in theory and in practice, we'd established a great rapport, I'd say.
Yes, I'd say. That was Patricia Broadwell when she was in our studios for an interview on David Petraeus from her book, All In, which has new meaning now, as you well know. We also heard from Willie Galloway talking about gardening, and you heard from Thomas Ricks there talking about Paula Broadwell. Sorry, did I say Patricia? Paula Broadwell. And we heard Thomas Ricks there talking about his new book, The Generals. Generals Petraeus and Allen are entwined in the zipper problems, as Thomas Ricks said, the unwinding sex affair scandal. General John Allen's appointment to be Supreme Allied Commander in Europe is on hold. General Petraeus, who went on to be head of the CIA, has now resigned. In his new book, author and journalist Thomas Ricks argues that generals in the United States Army have not lived under the fear of being relieved of duty the way they did during World War II, and that lax treatment of underperforming generals has allowed for subpar performance and a lack of accountability. Does firing generals mean that's the key to success of the U.S. military? We're going to talk with Thomas Ricks about that. He is also a fellow at the Center for New American Security. His previous books include Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. His new book is The Generals, The American Military Command from World War II to Today. Thomas Ricks, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Thomas Ricks joins us from the Marketplace Studios in Los Angeles, where you were on To the Point yesterday in Los Angeles, and we were listening to you, and of course, Zipper problems is what we're facing right now. Both, I guess your book is right out at the opportune moment, but at the same time, these are not the issues you're dealing with in The Generals, but these are the issues that have captivated us right now. Perhaps, as you said in another cut, which is the problem. We don't like their sex scandals because that embarrasses the institution, but the fact that they don't succeed on the battlefield, well, that's not such a big deal to some people.
Yeah, it does puzzle me why, for example, John Allen's emails constitute a scandal. Now, I understand there might be some problems with Petraeus, national security, possible blackmail, though I don't see it. But here you have a healthy Marine general based in Afghanistan who's writing emails to a woman back home. I don't understand, A, why that's a scandal, or B, why it is any of our business. It worries me that as a country, we don't judge people on their public official performance. We are very lax in our enforcement of standards of professionalism, of competence. Yet, we're very harsh about enforcing standards that involve consenting behavior, private behavior between adults. It just seems to me of a piece with the rather casual way in which we have fought the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that we only pay attention to these generals when there's something salacious or embarrassing. We don't pay attention. In fact, we put up with several years of incompetent leadership in the war in Iraq.
Oh, well, you looked back all the way to World War II in this book, The Generals. And were there... I guess we could look at Eisenhower, couldn't we, as somebody who had a private life that did not become public or did not interfere with his ability to perform his duties. What was the reality like in World War II for the line between public and private?
There was a pretty sharp line. Ike carried on pretty openly with his beautiful red-haired British driver, Kay Summersby. Finally, actually, General Marshall, the overall chief of staff, yanked the leash on that and said, you got to knock that off. But that was at the end of the war. imagine if there had been this scandal, quote-unquote scandal, with Eisenhower. Eisenhower palling around with beautiful young woman in January 44, and they say, you know, Ike, it's too bad, but you got to come home. Sure, you can't lead D-Day, and that means we're going to put some other guy in charge and soldiers are going to die, but that's the way it is. That's effectively what we're saying these days. Our standards have changed. It's not like we've always been puritanical about this. In the Korean War, Matthew Ridgway, a great commander, should be better known, turns the war around in early in 1951. He enforces competent standards. He actually wants to fire five of the six division commanders there. But in his private life, he's a womanizer. Kind of made a habit of getting a new wife for each war. I spent some time, in my 3.5 years of research for this book, The Generals, I spent a lot of time in the Army archives. And if you read through General Ridgway's papers, as I did, there's a lot of notes and cables back and forth about improving combat effectiveness. How do we get better combat leaders to the front? Because troops are dying because they're poorly led. Interspersed with all this are occasional very terse notes from his first wife's divorce lawyer.
Well, help me understand that. Why do you think there's this distinction? Because we usually of late say, the private action reflect the public person's abilities. That seems to be what we're implying in all these scandals.
I think it actually is a far nastier or more disappointing reason. Combat troops historically have put up with a lot of bad behavior from commanders if they could get one thing, leadership that kept them alive. Combat troops wanted to survive. And so historically, we had a lot of racist commanders, alcoholic commanders, and simple, pure sons of bitches like Patton. But the troops liked them because they had faith that these guys might get them through the war. That was all about combat effectiveness. We as a nation no longer understand that term. We don't know how to measure performance. We have gone to a situation where 1% of the nation fights our wars and 99% don't pay attention. As military parents use the phrase, we no longer have skin in the game. And so there's a kind of inattention and really a lack of seriousness in the way we execute these wars, the way we pay attention. And this is a problem of the American people not understanding the military anymore. It's a problem of a Congress that doesn't understand. As late as the Vietnam War, 2/3 of the Congress had military experience. Today, 2/3 do not. And it's a media that doesn't have military experience. But, you know, there's two things everybody thinks there's an expert on. There's an old saying in the newsroom, the two worst beats to have are sports and sex, because every editor thinks he's an expert. And it's so like, okay, we don't understand Sunni Shia, what's going on in Waziristan, Pakistan, undercutting Afghanistan, but we all think we understand a sex scandal. So suddenly we're paying attention. And I think it sort of speaks to a lack of seriousness in American life these days. In World War II, people took that war seriously. Now we kind of go on with these wars going on in the background and we don't pay attention. Now, World War II was an existential struggle. And these are small, messy, unpopular wars that we just wish we weren't involved in. Nonetheless, a soldier who gets blown up in eastern Afghanistan is every bit as dead as a soldier who gets machine gunned in Omaha Beach in D-Day 1944. And so, you know, we deserve it. People want to talk about supporting the troops. One way to support the troops is to give them good leaders. And we've tolerated mediocre generalship in both these wars for many, many years. And it just strikes me of a piece with the general immorality of carrying out these wars, of sort of inattention and just thinking it's somebody else's problem.
Well, you have also written that, this book, The Generals, is about the failure of the military itself to foster and promote the best people. Being the best combat people, the best people to understand how to run these wars, is that culture, which you say, you know, promotes mediocrity and people who keep their heads down, is that culture also a culture that, I am having a little trouble wrapping my head around why David Petraeus, who was on this trajectory, would make such a terrible a personal choice. And I mean, I do reflect back on, well, what kind of guy is that who would make that choice? What kind of leader is he if he would make such a dumb choice? Am I being puritanical?
No, I don't think you are. I think you're asking the right question. But the answer is not somehow he's not the guy that we all thought he was. I think the answer is he has been through hell. We have put our troops through many more tours of combat than troops in World War II had. David Petraeus has done 3 combat tours in Iraq. He's done another combat tour in Afghanistan, and he's been under enormous stress in other jobs, front lines and other places since 9/11. Basically, he has gone nonstop since 9/11. His family and he have been very generous with their time and with their entire lives. And it bothers me that when the time came for us as a nation to be generous in return, we were not. What has happened to Dave Petraeus? In addition to his 5 combat tours, this is a guy who, in a parachuting accident, had a smashed pelvis, and his pelvis is held together with a series of iron bolts, steel bolts, who also was in a training accident, shot through the chest, and, as I said, 5 combat tours. I think this guy has been through enormous pressure and stress, and I think he slipped. He had a lapse. I am not surprised to see that in someone who has carried the extravagant stress of combat for so long. We should not be surprised when people break a road. This is what war does to people. The other part of your question is Army culture changing? The answer is yes. This was the great surprise to me in the book. I had covered the military for years and years, but I did not realize that in World War II, relief of generals was very common, because in the modern era, it's very uncommon. In World War II, George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, gave senior commanders about 90 days to succeed, get killed, or get fired. And it was a Darwinian system. It was tough. He put 3 people through a lot of tests, and a lot of people got moved out. 155 men commanded Army divisions in combat in World War II. Of the 155, 16 were fired. But there is also an element of forgiveness in this. Of the 16 generals who were fired from combat commands, 5 were given other combat commands later in the war. So it was a very tough Darwinian system. It weeded people out. So nobody can tell you who Lloyd Fredendall is today, because he was fired as a senior general, the top general in the front lines in the first part of the war in Africa and Europe. One of my favorite trivia questions is, who is Major General James Cheney? And I ask military audiences, and no one knows. The answer is, James Cheney was Eisenhower's predecessor as the American commander in Europe.
For how long?
Marshall fought. About 8 months.
Wow.
Marshall fired him, and he wound up the war commanding a boot camp in Wichita Falls, I think Texas or Kansas, wherever it is. I think it's Texas. These guys got moved out. And as the failures got moved out, new people were moved up quickly, which is why we know names today like Matthew Ridgway, James Gavin, and most famously, Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower did not begin the war as a general. In the beginning of 1940, he was lieutenant colonel, executive commander of an infantry regiment in Vancouver, Washington.
Right.
Of course, Marshall moved him up quickly. He said, this is the type of guy I need. Marshall spent a lot of time thinking, what's the job and who would fit it? What are the characteristics of the job I have on hand here and who would fit it? And he picked Eisenhower for Eisenhower's personal characteristics.
Yeah. All right, Thomas Ricks, let me take a break. And then let's come back and jump through some of these people that you profile in the generals, American Military Command from World War II to today. Thomas Ricks is also author of Fiasco. This is Weekday.
It's 10:19. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information.
Maybe you've heard of the kill list of Al-Qaeda leaders in Yemen. It's said to contain just 10 to 15 names. So what is the U.S. doing?
This year, it's carried out anywhere from 37 to 50 strikes in Yemen. Either the drone strikes aren't as accurate, or the U.S. is targeting many more individuals than those 10 to 15 on its list.
America's war in Yemen, next time on The World.
That story and much more this afternoon at 4 on our second program service, KUOW2.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, featuring 1,400 channels of on-demand entertainment at every seat. Non-stop flights to Dubai depart from Seattle daily. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
We have cloudy skies and 51 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting clouds and showers the rest of today, the high getting up to 52. Same for tonight, clouds and showers, the low in the low 40s.
History has been kind to the American generals of World War II, Marshall, Eisenhower, Patton, Bradley. Less kind to the generals that followed. Thomas Ricks has set out to figure out why in his book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to today. He is a fellow at the Center for New American Security. Thomas Ricks is speaking about his book at the Seattle Public Library on November 16th at 7 o'clock. So Thomas Ricks, first of all, just a little more about George C. Marshall. He's your standard by which you're judging a lot of these other generals. What, and you talked about that Darwinian system that he put into place to test commanders and move them out if they weren't good, move other people up. What was Marshall's background? What was his notion that sets him apart as a leader?
George Marshall was a great man, a good man, a decent man, but I don't think he was a nice man. He was quite cold with people. He didn't invent the Darwinian system, but he kind of perfected it. It resulted from seeing American military tradition going back to the Revolution of relieving unsuccessful commanders, accountability. In the Revolution, in the Civil War, and especially in World War I, when he was an aide to the top American commander, General Jack Pershing. He kind of, though, perfected it in sort of this extreme accountability of World War II, which is, you've just got a very short time to get it right, or I will move you out. Marshall had a seriousness to him about the entire enterprise. This is a guy who's taking the U.S. Army from about 185,000 people on the day he becomes Army Chief of Staff, September 1, 1939, to about 8.5 million people 6 years later in 1945. Basically, he presides over the creation of the modern American superpower military. He's a very interesting character, Marshall. He has a habit of speaking his mind, speaking truth to power. He did that with General Pershing in World War I when he first met him. He basically, as a captain, spoke up and said, "Look, General, you've got it wrong. Let me tell you why." Everybody thought he'd be fired. Later on, as a brigadier general, a one-star general, he's in a meeting in the Oval Office with President Roosevelt. And President Roosevelt is kind of concluding the meeting in his Machiavellian way, sort of making sure everybody's on board. And he says, "Isn't that right, George?" And Marshall does two things. First of all, he makes it clear that he wants to be addressed as General Marshall, not as George. And second, he says, "No, it isn't. And here's why I disagree." And Roosevelt's kind of taken aback. And Roosevelt, though, knows he needs generals who are going to tell him really the straight story. And so Marshall becomes chief of staff of the Army. He's picked by Roosevelt, not the natural candidate, actually Hugh Drum, who is now forgotten, except for Fort Drum, New York, being named after him. Hugh Drum was sort of the more natural candidate. So Marshall becomes Army chief of staff. And again, later in another meeting in the Oval Office on May 13th, 1940, Roosevelt, again, kind of pulls one of these stunts where he says, "Well, I'm sure we all agree." And Marshall actually rather angrily stands up and says, "No, I don't agree, Mr. President, and here's why. You need to listen to me here." And so they have a very good, candid relationship. It's not a close relationship. Marshall purposely keeps his distance from the president. He doesn't like to have dinner with him. He refuses to laugh at his jokes. The first time he ever visits President Roosevelt's home in Hyde Park, New York, is for Roosevelt's funeral. Nonetheless, they wage this war really well. It's, to me, a model of civil military discourse in which the top general speaks truth to power, but then, when the order is given, carries it out even if he disagrees. In fact, Marshall's motto is, when you disagree with an order, you must give an extra 10% of effort in executing it, 110%. So, for example, Marshall objects to Roosevelt's plan for Operation Torch, the American landings in North Africa, in late 1942. Marshall thinks that Roosevelt's doing it for callous, selfish political reasons. There's an election coming up in November 42. Nonetheless, goes ahead and does it. As we know now, it was actually military necessity. We needed to get our troops and our commanders better at fighting. If we had tried to go up against the Germans first in 1942-43, we would have been smashed and probably thrown back off the beaches. So we needed that shakedown cruise in Africa just to get better. So Roosevelt was not just politically right, he was militarily right. And Marshall, I think, learned from this in working with him.
So Thomas Ricks, now I'm going to jump ahead because this is a thick book. There's a lot here, and I'm going to just jump ahead because in this book, you are arguing for speaking truth to power. You're arguing for accountability of the generals. You're arguing for a sense of understanding what the civilian leadership's duty is, but also what the military's duty is to those civilian leaders. So I want to skip over Korea and Vietnam, where you talk about that a lot and what happened to the military afterwards. And I want to ask you—
And where they lose the tradition of accountability, by the way, in those two wars.
Right, right. And then you take us to the first Iraq war, where it seems to me that Powell and Schwarzkopf and Cheney do something initially that might be along the lines of what you're talking about, but then it breaks down, it seems.
Yeah. The interesting thing to me about the Gulf War is it shows both the good of how the U.S. Army was rebuilt after Vietnam, but also the bad. The good is that the U.S. Army was rebuilt after Vietnam. The Army was smashed by the Vietnam War. And during the late 70s and the 80s, they re-equipped the force, they retrained the force, and most importantly, they took another course and how they took another direction in actually how to man the force. They lose the draft and they go with an all-volunteer force. In this magnificent rebuilding of the Army, however, there's one thing they don't do. They don't change generalship. So it's almost like putting the old head on the new body. So you get this army that's very focused on winning the first battle in the next war, but is absolutely clueless about how to fight a war and end it. And so we have Norman Schwarzkopf go in and kind of, with the support of his civilian leaders, declare a ceasefire pretty fast in the 1991 Gulf War. We now know that Saddam Hussein didn't understand why he was being given the ceasefire. He thought it maybe was because the Americans were scared or something, but he thought he had won a victory in the 91 war. We now know from the cabinet tapes that were captured of his cabinet meetings, he said, "I don't know why the Americans are doing this, but this is great. I, Saddam Hussein, have taken on the American superpower, their British and Saudi Arabian allies, and I've survived. In the Arab world, that's a big thing. That's a victory." So we give him what he thinks is a victory. We don't end the war right. I'm not saying go to Baghdad, but there are other things we could have done. And so it turns out the 1991 Gulf War, which people thought was a triumph at the time, turns out simply to have been the beginning of a 20-year-long war with Iraq.
Now, I remember talking to you when you wrote Fiasco about how you saw these current wars wrapping up, and you said, you know, we're going to be there for a long time. 2015, 2016, maybe later. And of course, we are.
Well, we're not in Iraq. I was wrong about that.
I thought
we would have American forces on the ground in Iraq. And I think this was actually the great achievement of Dave Petraeus, is he managed to get us out of Iraq with some shreds of decency and extricate the U.S. military. Now, what people forget is the war in Iraq hasn't ended. We're just not in it. Iraq right now is more violent than Afghanistan is. We just don't care.
Right. And that's where I was going with this. I mean, we talk about these generals, and you list the people that didn't know what they were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. Did they speak, even Petraeus, did they speak truth to power? Did they tell the leadership what was actually happening?
I think Petraeus did speak truth to power. I think other commanders did not. But there are two parts to this equation. Roosevelt knew he needed to hear the truth. I think today's civilian leaders are not so sure they want to hear it. And that's not a partisan knock. I think it's true of both Republicans and Democrats. Colin Powell scared the political world. Here was this military officer who kind of achieved an independent political base. And you notice since Powell, they have chosen as the top military officer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the politicians have chosen lower profile people, people who will not become a political challenge. They don't want to be challenged. I'm an Obama fan. I think he's a fine president, but he worries me a little bit in his national security matters, partly because he's so determined not to be a war president. He saw how George Bush wanted to be the education president and had his presidency consumed by Iraq. He has talked about, reading about the Vietnam War, his nightmare is President Johnson, LBJ, who had a large, ambitious, and very good domestic program and saw his presidency destroyed by Vietnam. So I think when President Obama sees a general walking through his front door, he kind of sees William Westmoreland, the general in Vietnam. You know, are you going to show up and mess up my domestic agenda by focusing me on wars? So it's two things. It's the generals need to speak truth to power, and the civilians have to be willing to hear it.
All right. Well, when you're looking at Afghanistan today and this plan to get us out of there, our troops out of there, are the people in power the leaders you want them, that you hope for, or are we still seeing the promotion of the mediocre?
Actually, John Allen, the Marine commander in Iraq, who's kind of surfacing in the headlines today for his own private personal emails that we somehow think are our business, he, I think, is quite a good commander. But the system is kind of inattentive. He is going to be replaced by another Marine general, General Dunford, who will become the 11th American commander in Afghanistan in 11 years. So even if you have a good general, the system is mediocre. Can you imagine having 11 CEOs of a corporation in 11 years?
Well, your argument is it should be Darwinian, but you're also saying that once you find somebody who's good, don't mandatorily move them on. Let them do a little work there. But you also you're trying to avoid the burnout at the same time. This is a tough road to hoe.
It is. Nobody said war is easy. It's enormously difficult. I think war is in some ways a collective psychotic operation, but it also is probably generalship is the most difficult job there is because it involves both intellectual and physical energy, and it's very draining, especially when friends and loved ones get killed around you, which happens. So I think there's this casual arrogance in the way we just run the whole system. That's a phrase a friend of mine, Andrew Exum, who fought in Afghanistan, used. The casual arrogance of rotating 11 commanders through. Warren Buffett once said that if you've been playing poker for half an hour and you don't know who the patsy at the table is, you're the patsy.
I was struck
when
by... Go ahead.
When you put 11 commanders in Afghanistan, our commander is always the patsy. Everyone else, Karzai, the Taliban, they've been around for 11 years. They know what's going on. Our guy is sitting there trying to figure it out, and by the time he figures it out, it's time to go home.
Yeah, I was struck by that story you told of the Iraqi commanders who figured out that the way to deal with new people coming in leadership, this was at the platoon level and higher, said, yeah, first we fought with them, then we kind of told them we'd do their work, and then we sort of towards the end of their tour, we'd say, oh, let's work down and implement some of your reforms, and then they'd be gone. So they knew how to manipulate
exactly
the system.
And those were our allies. I mean, let alone, you know, your enemies are also watching you and figuring how to manipulate that. And I think they really do see that this rotation means, like in Vietnam, we haven't been fighting one war for 11 years. We've been fighting over and over again, one year at a time, a new war each year.
So I was struck by one thing to end this with that you wrote about, which is that let's get these people who are going to be leaders, the majors and the colonels and the captains even, let's get them out, let's get them to go to school, let's get them to get master's degrees, let's get them to think about and study all the things that are happening. And we see some of that. But you also said that some of the war colleges are little more than, I mean, I'm putting the word in here, but you were basically saying they were like the easiest schools. They were the party schools. This is not what we expect from the people who are training to be leaders of our armies.
Yeah, a lot of people in the military see the war college as a year to kind of, you know, regroup with your family, play some golf, and maybe read a few books. One of the characteristics I've seen of better generals, generals who are able to think critically, who are not just trained but also educated, Training prepares you for the known. Education prepares you for the unknown. The characteristic of those generals who stand out, Petraeus, another one is H.R. McMaster, is that they have advanced degrees from good civilian universities that have challenged them, have challenged all their assumptions and made them think. Petraeus did a Ph.D. at Princeton. H.R. McMaster, another terrific younger general, did a very good Ph.D. at the University of North Carolina and wrote what, for my money, is one of the best books in the Vietnam War, Dereliction of Duty.
All right. Thomas Rick's book is The General's American Military Command from World War II to Today. Thomas Ricks, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Thomas Ricks will be speaking about his book at the Seattle Public Library on November 16th at 7 p.m. This is Weekday. Clear your head with some music, and then leave us to garden. Marty Wingate writes about garden and travel. She works at MartyWingate.com. Her book is Landscaping for Privacy. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
And Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward, works on habitat restoration, salmon recovery, Vashon and Maury Islands. He's also co-host of King County TV's Yard Talk.
Hello.
And we'll be talking to Willie Galloway pretty soon. She's host of the gardening and cooking website, DigginFood.com. Her book is Grow, Cook, Eat. Did I mention Landscaping for Privacy?
You did. Thank you very much.
Sometimes I'm on autopilot, apparently. That's bad. I dug up a bunch of... Hello, Willie.
Hello.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I dug up some trees, some little sprouts, some snowberry, filbert. Looked pretty good. I think I did a good job.
You dug them up to transplant them someplace.
Put them into some pots for now. Going to give them to some friends.
Put them into some pots. This sounds like Greg's garden. loads and loads of native plants in pots.
I really was really wanted to get enough root. But on some of the snowberry, I don't know if I did. What shall I do for that?
You don't have to worry about snowberry. You can just take cuttings of snowberry and it roots very readily. It's a great plant to propagate.
So. How about Indian plum?
Emeleria?
Yeah, I haven't grown that from cuttings, so I don't know how it does, but it's... Usually you can cut off, it'll have multi-stems and
yes.
Send up some, and you can chop off part of that and transplant that with root. And Indian plum transplants really well as well.
All right, all these native plants. And then the filbert was not a native, but it's, southern.
We have a native.
Yeah, but I don't think I was growing the native.
Oh.
But it's still pretty easy to transplant if you get those roots.
Yes.
All right. I'm just doing all this work. I know other people are transplanting things right now.
Yeah.
It's a good time to transplant, right? Dig up and transplant.
Yeah, it's a great time.
That's what you've been doing.
Yeah.
You've been planting.
Yeah, well, relocating. No, I still haven't got to those pots, embarrassingly enough.
Oh, and I have no pots in the garden waiting to go in. None.
Oh. What about you, Willie? What do you got?
I just started kind of reviewing the past year and thinking about what varieties did well for me and kind of what I want to do next year while it's still fresh in my mind. Because in February, when I'm making out my list of what I want to order, sometimes I'm like, what was that tomato again? And so I still have all my seed packets from this year and everything. And I was just kind of the other day looking over them and thinking, oh, I liked that arugula, but I think I want to try this leek next year. And so it's, I feel like this time of year is kind of a good time to review because it's still what you grew and your successes and failures are still fairly fresh in your mind.
Are you reviewing at this point?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
I haven't reached that reflective period yet. I'm still trying to get all my garlic planted before I eat it all. It's a problem.
Yeah, you should plant that.
I should.
This is garlic you already grew?
No, this is garlic that I bought specifically for the garden. However, it's sitting next to, up on the windowsill next to where the garlic that I cook with is.
And what's the difference?
Well, none at this point. I'm actually eating my way quite nicely through my garlic that's supposed to go in the garden.
You could still throw it in there, right? You still plant it.
Oh, yeah. It's just a matter of, will I have enough left to plant?
Are you reviewing?
I am. I started my autumn winter bird list on my Facebook page this morning.
Did you?
So I did. Yeah.
What did you see?
Well, so it's a running list. We have a nuthatch, chickadees, Buick's wren, winter wren, Steller's jay, robin, flicker, and tons of bush tits. And there was a sharp shin hawk sitting out on one of the patio chairs the other day. So I went out and had a talk with him.
Why? That's what he's there for.
Rats. Eat rats.
I see.
That's what I want him to eat.
How'd that work out?
Not well.
Rats with a bush tit chaser, right?
Oh, yeah.
No.
All right. What are you folks thinking about? What are you reviewing in your garden? Our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869, or email us weekday at kuow.org. Quick break. We'll get to your calls.
California is about to require permits for big companies that emit greenhouse gases, and that could benefit green entrepreneurs.
Because we offset greenhouse gases, it's not quite a gold rush yet, but if the prices turn out to be good, it will become one.
I'm Steve Inskeep. A cap and trade program becomes reality on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That story and much more tomorrow morning from 5 until 9 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:42.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Good Business Network, presenting the semi-annual Dine Around Seattle, featuring three-course dinners of appetizer, entree, and dessert at Seattle area restaurants. Sundays through Thursdays, November 4th through the 29th. More details online at dinearoundseattle.org.
We have cloudy skies and 51 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 52 today. Forecast calls for clouds and showers all day. Same for tonight, clouds and showers, the low in the low 40s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow with just a chance of showers. Tomorrow's high in the low 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Best of the Northwest Art and Fine Craft Show this weekend at Seattle's Smith Cove Cruise Terminal on Pier 91, featuring 250 Northwest artists selling handcrafted jewelry, fashions, paintings, glass art, and more. Live music and wine tastings this Friday through Sunday. Information at nwartalliance.com.
You are listening to Weekday on KUOW Seattle. We're going to still get a hike from Michael Fagan in and some sound. But right now, we wanted to get you to talk to us about what's happening in your garden or maybe some questions you have for Greg Rayburn, who thinks about these things as the Vashon-Maury Island Basin Steward. Willie Galloway, who thinks about these things as the host of the gardening and cooking website Diggin' Food. Or Marty Wingate, who thinks about these things as the host of her own MartyWingate.com and her landscaping for privacy. You know what I was thinking while we wait for you to call at 206-543-5869. 1-800-289-5869. It's a good time to think about, landscaping for privacy because things have sort of fallen away and you can get a sense of what's happening.
If you're aiming to grow a mixed hedge along your alley, for example, where would that be? My house. It is a good time. As the leaves fall off the hazelnut, our native hazelnut, I realize that I might need another evergreen or two in there. So I do have a mix of evergreens. I have an Asian Mahonia, which is about to start blooming and will feed the hummingbirds over the winter.
Is it tall?
It is, yeah. It's about 7 feet tall right now, and I will probably cut one of the tallest stems back and let it fluff out a little bit more in the middle. I have a yew back there, and I have a viburnum tinus, which is evergreen. So, and a Zara, fabulous screen. It's kind of a see-through screen. So I can see where the holes are, and I like being able to see through some places, but you know,
yeah,
places I want something blocked.
By the way, I guess it's Alicia writes, last year Marty raved about beautiful new privacy tree for narrow spaces. I think she said it was available at Swanson's Nursery. Any update about how well it's doing, and what was the name of that?
I believe that that's probably that Japanese umbrella pine that I went on and on about. And the cultivar is called Joe Cozy, K-O-Z-E-Y. And it is available. You could ask at your local nursery, and it's probably available online as well. It's not in my garden yet. That's what I need to put back there in the mixed hedge. So I would like to hear from some people, because I know some people bought it and put it in. So let's see if we can get some reaction.
All right, fair enough.
Joe Cozy fans.
Joe Cozy is a great name for a cultivar.
It is, yeah.
I planted my garlic, bought from the farmer's market on 1010, Junan writes, but so far they still didn't sprout. What could be the cause? Is there anything I need to do? Willie, you first. Why did that garlic sprout?
They might not sprout till spring, so... No worries. Just it's hanging out. It's probably growing its roots. And, you know, if you planted it, usually garlic is planted 1 to 2 inches deep. So if you plant it on a little deeper side, it'll take a little bit longer for those sprouts to come up. But and sometimes they don't come up at all until spring. So it's nothing to worry about.
All right. Anything you want to add to that, or is that good? All right. Allison writes, I have some strawberry plants I want to transplant. I think I put them in a spot that's too shady. What's the ideal spot for strawberry plants, and what's a good time to transplant them? You want to take that, Willie?
Sure. Now's a good time to transplant them. They like full sun, so raised beds are good for them, but you just want to get them in a spot where they get at least 6 hours of bright direct sunlight each day.
There's a lot of runners sort of flopping around in my strawberry plants, so this would be a good time to cut them and move them.
Yeah, if those runners have rooted and you want to expand your strawberry patch, you could dig up the daughter plants and move them.
All right. Peggy's on the south end. Hi, Peggy.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm very good. You had some pruning questions.
Yeah, I have an abutilon that I almost killed, or the frost almost killed twice. And the one that came back with a fury. It's got a little big. I'm going to prune it and preserve it for next year. And I'm going to do the same thing with some hardy fuchsias. What do you recommend?
Are these in the ground or in pots?
In the ground.
Yeah. I would not cut the abutilon back now. I would not cut the hardy fuchsias back now, just because during mild weather you don't want them. You don't want to suggest to them that they might want to sprout. So give them a good mulch, leaf mulch or something like that. You know, around the roots, and that way, if nothing sprouts from the top, you'll get something sprouting from the roots in the spring. And with the hardy fuchsias, it's up to you. You'll read a lot of advice that says, wait until you see a leaf in the spring and then cut it down to the ground. I don't cut my hardy fuchsia down to the ground. I like it to be a big shrub.
Where do you cut it?
I will cut selective branches, and sometimes I will just cut back to a branch that is flowering, because not every single branch, or leaf out, because not every single branch will leaf out.
So but you thin it out and you cut it down a little
bit.
I do,
yeah. So we have one really big one along the side, which is just a straight species, Fuchsia magellanica, and then we have two or three smaller ones that come up every year. But you can wait until spring.
All right. Go ahead.
What's a abutilon?
Oh, an abutilon. It used to be called the flowering maple. It used to be an indoor plant, a house plant, until someone realized that in a lot of areas it will grow outside. And they have these wonderful flowers in shades of red and yellow and pink, and they look like. They look like the old-fashioned skirts that women would wear during the Civil War with hoops underneath them. That's what the flowers look like. They're just...
A-B-U-T-I-L-O-N?
Yes, abutilon.
Abutilon. Oh, great. I like that. All right.
Thanks for that, Peggy. David's in Bellevue. Oh, David, here, that's a question for Greg, just because he's going to moan. What's your question, David?
How do I get rid of holly, and does holly have any redemptive value for wildlife in terms of providing food or whatever?
Holly, some birds, particularly robins, will eat the berries, and unfortunately, that's how it spreads so readily, and that's why it's such a problem invasive. If you look at an infestation, you know, like a city park, there, what they found is that there'll be a perch tree that is the preferred place for the robins to fly after they eat a bunch of the berries. And then from that perch tree, you'll see all these holly seedlings working out from that. So it is a real problem invasive, and it's hard to get rid of. And that's one of those things where if it's small enough, you can get out all the root, that's your best option.
Well, it's not just here, but I've noticed on Tiger Mountain and Mount Si that there are healthy populations of the holly starting up. And is there like a even my neighbor has a fairly large tree. I mean, is that something that you could use a copper spike on? Or I know that just cutting it, you just get a lot of the little sprouts coming out of the ground.
Yeah, if you're going to pull it, you need to do it when it's young. They've been experimenting with a technique called frilling, which involves herbicide, which they actually cut into the side of it all the way around. It is one of those things that suckers so profusely. But that's one to contact the King County Noxious Weed Control Program about, and they can get into specifics on it. But it's one of those that once they're mature, and if you cut them down, then they sucker so profusely, and then you lost your lever. Remember a while back we had a caller who would get rid of his holly by pruning up his limbs, and then he would use that big, the remaining trunk as a big lever to try and get up more of the roots that way.
Interesting.
What was that word? Frilling?
Frilling.
F-R-I-L-L-I-N-G?
Yes.
Yeah, boy, that's so a says-you word if I ever heard it.
So it's not it's not a matter of, so you're not broadcasting an herbicide all over an area, which on a tree you can imagine how much that would be. Instead, it's almost like stem injection, but on a tree. So it's very localized.
I love use. English holly in England.
Yeah, that's where it belongs.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for that. Here, one last phone call here. Peter's on Queen Anne. Hi, Peter.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, what are some good vegetables to plant now for the spring? And I'm especially interested in green beans.
Well, green beans, too early for green beans, right, Willie Galloway?
You know, unfortunately, at this time of year, you've kind of missed your planting window. So if you have a cold frame, you could plant some greens maybe. But the problem is right now it's so dark that stuff doesn't really grow. So what you're going to want to do is maybe instead focus on getting your beds ready for next spring, maybe building a hoop house over your beds, and then in, let's say, late February, seeding some lettuces, arugula, bok choy, other cool season greens in. But you're not going to be planting green beans until late May.
I guess that takes us back to that garlic, huh?
Yeah, yep. Garlic, shallots are good.
Garlic and shallots. All right, any last words, any of you?
Plant Amnesty Celebrity Auction, Wednesday, December 5th. You can come and bid on all sorts of things.
On you?
On me, yes. You could bid on Cisco. You can bid on Deborah Prinzing.
To come and give some suggestions?
I will come and give a free garden talk. Well, free, because you bid on it and have paid for it. A garden talk to your group.
Very cool. Any last words from you, Greg?
Nope.
Nothing? You got nothing for me? Get those pots planted.
Yeah, exactly.
Willie, any last words?
Well, I think this is a good time of year to try different squashes from the farmer's market to see what you might want to plant in your own garden next year.
Very nice. I've been doing that.
But just remember to write down the name.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Good point.
All right. Willie Galloway hosts gardening and cooking website Diggin' Food, and she's author of Grow, Cook, Eat. She's in Portland. Greg Rayburn is right here, the Vashon Basin steward, works on habitat restoration. And Marty Wingate is a writer of gardening and travel. Her latest book is Landscaping for Privacy. He writes at MartyWingate.com. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for your phone calls, your emails. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of our bicycle correspondent, Willie Weir, and his wife, Kat, pedaling across the world's longest teak footbridge in Mandalay. Willie says the bridge was covered with young lovers, monks, school kids, families out for a stroll. As he rode, loose boards squeaked and chattered as the bike tires rolled over them. The world's longest teak bridge. Willie says people were fishing from the bridge and women waded out in the waters below using a two-pole, two-hand fishing technique. He's never seen that anywhere in the world. We got pictures at our Facebook page. You can read more about what they're doing at their website, Yellow Tent Adventures. Michael Fagan, what kind of adventure do you have for us? And thanks for moving an hour as we our autism show went a little long. What kind of adventures do you have for us, Michael Fagan?
Actually, it's interesting you have the bike sound because the trail we picked is actually open to bikes, although I didn't quite hear that sound. So just be aware that there are some bikes on the trail. This trail is the Grand Ridge Trail right outside of Issaquan. It's very handy to have, with the short daylight. It's quick and easy to do. In fact, I just did it this past Sunday. Left my house in Redmond at 9 a.m., hiked 8 miles round trip back home to watch the second half of the Seahawks game. So that was a win-win situation. Another highlight, there's no snow on the trail. We're starting to get some snow in the mountains, so hopefully we'll have a trip next week that involves a ski or snowshoe. This trip is in a lush forest, moss-draped trees, lots of ferns. It's good rain or shine, and if you're looking for rain, we'll get some rain today and some rain over the week. And if you're looking for a drier scenario for a hike later on Wednesday and Thursday. And this does not require any forest pass. It's Green Trails Map 204S. And we have that information on the blog, and we also have a link to the King County where it has a map of the entire region. And this trail is as long as or as short as you like it. It's 9.5 miles one way, up to 1,000 feet gain. This past Sunday, we did 8 miles round trip with a 500-foot gain, so reasonable mileage. And if you don't go on this hike, I do want to make people aware it's hunting season. There's no hunting in this particular hike, but it is hunting season in a lot of regions, so wear bright colors. And on a note of the snow, Chinook Pass and Cayuse Pass have just closed, so the snow's starting to come up in the mountains.
Wow, no kidding. All right. I like these pictures at FaganWeatherWorld.blogspot.com, including some people crossing a nice bridge. Is this a mixed forest or is this an old forest? It looks like it's been logged in some places.
Yeah, it has been logged. It's a second growth, but boy, some of the trees are quite large. And, you take a quick look in some of the sections and you think it's old growth, but it isn't. It was logged a while ago, and this was an interesting section of forest. Some logging company owned it, and then they sold it to a real estate developer, and part of the deal was when they built the real estate development that they'd keep some of this forest intact. So we're lucky to have it, and actually, if I'm not mistaken, there's a bike path. I don't know if it's quite finished, but it goes from Issaquah to Preston. So this is a lot of different type of uses on here. We saw people running, biking, and hiking. So this is just a real fun place to go.
That's the Grand Ridge hike at the Grand Ridge Trail. Michael has links at FaganWeatherWorld.blogspot.com. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC, and he joins us every week to give us some hikes to match the weather. Thank you, Michael.
You bet.
Thank you, folks, for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow on weekday on KULW Seattle. Stick around. To the Point's coming up.
Good morning. It's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW is brought to you by the Seattle Art Museum, presenting Elle, Women Artists from the Centre Pompidou, Paris, featuring 130 works by 75 women artists, now open Tuesday through Sunday. Information at seattleartmuseum.org.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.